Welcome back. We are here with the two wonderful people, two of my favorite people, Anava Shadeya, who's with us in studio once again.
Hi.
Always good to have her here. Singer, songwriter, co-founder and director of the Healing and Performing Arts at the Youth Resiliency Institute, and the co-founder and executive director of the Youth Resiliency Institute, Fanon Hill, is with us, who's also her husband and trainer for the National Rites of Passage Institute. Good to have you both here.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
Always good to see you two.
You too.
Likewise.
It's one of our cultural power couples sitting in the studio. So I wanted to talk to you all today because of what's been going on in Baltimore, but also because of what's been happening in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. You two have been to Cleveland recently, but you both grew up in Cleveland. Your family's in Cleveland. You still yep. work in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get a sense from the two of you about what is happening there before we mm-hmm. talk about the differences and similarities to our cities.
Right.
Can you talk
right.
to us a bit about from the inside out,
right.
Fanon?
Right, right. Well, you know, first and foremost, quite interestingly, the parking lot where Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams were killed by Cleveland police
yeah.
is connected to the middle school that I attended, 7th and 8th grade at. And I recall as a student there being taught by some of the fiercest educators you can imagine. East Cleveland is a so-called low-income black community, very rich in self-determination. And I remember many of my teachers at that time preparing myself and my peers to confront some of the toughest challenges of the time, of the day. And to be an adult, to be a man, and to understand that and to recognize that many of the conversations I had with my former teachers had to do with the importance of equality, police brutality. And this is like during the 90s. Here we are in 2015. And, you know, yet a few years ago, we had two individuals who were brutally, you know, murdered mm-hmm. by Cleveland police.
137 shots fired.
East Cleveland. And, you know, Brelo actually jumping on, officer Brelo jumping on the hood and firing shots, you know, into that vehicle. And it was so brutal that when the families went to identify the bodies, and people need to understand this, the families could not positively ID the bodies of their family members who were murdered because they had no faces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to have grown up in East Cleveland, to be in Baltimore, to be dealing with what's happening, taking place today in Baltimore, what's taking place in Cleveland, is for me in many ways a surreal mm-hmm. experience. But it's holding me accountable, helping me to celebrate even that much more those individuals in my family, community activists who are no longer here, who spent their life fighting, you know, for justice and equality. And so the fight continues on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I mean, for me, it's very, very emotional because I have family in East Cleveland and Cleveland proper, but in East Cleveland where I grew up as well. And I was just talking to my little brother today. And he said that he was just sitting in his car with his friend. The police pulled up in front of our house.
This is recently?
Yeah, today.
Oh, today.
And we were just casually talking today. And he said that his friend, I think he had to, you know, do something with his car or something. But the cops got out of the car and had their guns out point blank to shoot them. My brother was thinking, why do you want to shoot us? And he just thought about, you know, just what people have to go through there, what he's experienced as far as police intimidation and police brutality. And even just considering rioting or not, he's just saying that a lot of people are very fearful because of just the brutality, how they could get killed just from rioting. The rioting is very sporadic right now in different parts of the city. And it's spread out. You know, Midwest is a little spread out than Baltimore, but
right.
it's spread out. But people are marching and people are trying to figure out a solution. But it's very scary right now for him. He's just saying he's just scared. A lot of people are just scared because they're thinking, you know, I could just get killed now. And no matter what, and a person can get off. So it's like you can just be murdered by the police and no one will do anything. So it's just very scary right now for a lot of the people in Cleveland.
What about what the mayor is saying and about the changes about to take place with the police department and the mm-hmm. reforms they're talking about mm-hmm. and having to
right.
the paperwork and all the things the police are going to have to do to change the way they behave? Well, what's your sense of that? And
exactly. So check this out. This is something that's very interesting that a lot of people are not aware of. Less than 10 years ago, the Department of Justice investigated the Cleveland Police Department, mm-hmm. and they reached a settlement. Once again, a consent decree settlement. And so it's just very sad and ironic that here we are in 2015 and you have the city council in Cleveland, Ohio, many city council members who are speaking about a reality, and that reality being that the city does not have the monies to implement many of the reforms that individuals are speaking about. But yet, you know, over the last 10 years, the city has spent millions of dollars settling cases of brutality. So the question becomes, you know, are these reforms going to stick? How serious is the Cleveland Police Department when it comes to actually implementing these reforms yet another time, you know, a second time? Here we are in 2015, so we're back to square one.
So, I mean, you've lived in both places, and you still work in both places.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a program in that very middle school you were talking about, right?
Yes.
So how do you compare the two cities? People always say that things are, experiences are different, the places are different. How do you compare them politically, first of all, and in terms of police? And
go to police. You'd speak about that.
Well, so my grandfather and grandmother, they actually migrated from Alabama to Cleveland, Ohio.
Is that where most of the black folks in Cleveland come from, Alabama?
Yeah, Mississippi, Alabama.
Like here in Baltimore, it's North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, but Cleveland is Alabama.
That train brought us up, you know, with that good blues and, you know, even the foods. You know, you go to Ohio, specifically Cleveland, and you smell ribs. You know,
all
no
the time.
Seafood, just
lima
smell
beans,
just
macaroni and cheese. I mean, it's like the corner store food. Isn't that crazy?
The 15,
no chicken boxes.
15
no,
degrees
I think I like
below.
That better, though. It sounds good.
You know, so you know, you have that that energy, that lineage in Cleveland to this day. And so my grandfather, my grandmother, they migrated. My father's mother and father migrated to Cleveland, and they ended up living in public housing in Cleveland, Ohio, the same public housing complex that an individual by the name of Carl Stokes and his family lived in at the time.
First brother, black mayor, first black mayor in
America. Louis Stokes.
Right.
And so there were a number of individuals who lived within this public housing unit, which was in the central community in Ohio, because that was pretty much the only community that black folk could live in at the time, for the most part, in Cleveland. So it was very rich in terms of kinship and the conversation about conversations about self-determination, about history, so on and so forth. And it was very vibrant. So many of those individuals who came of age in the central community went on to be, as you know, just mentioned, you know, mayors, elected officials, educators, so on and so forth. So for me, you know, having relocated to Baltimore City and really beginning to understand just the richness when it comes to, you know, the civil rights tradition in Baltimore. Last time I was here, you spoke to me about Perrin Mitchell.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, just these iconic figures.
Just yesterday was the anniversary, 2 days was the anniversary of his passing.
Right, exactly. Right. You know, and I can't stop thinking to myself, what would Perrin Mitchell be saying today? You know, what would Carl Stokes be saying today? What would my grandfather, who actually, during the Glenville riots, the Glenville shooting, Carl Stokes would not allow white police officers to patrol Glenville. He insisted that black police officers patrol Glenville, and then he reached out to community leaders, champions, everyday mothers, fathers, who were well respected. One of those individuals being my grandfather, and after that, you know, in terms of the violence, it ceased. You know, it ceased. So, in terms of understanding the power of courageous political leadership, and being in Baltimore City today, which is very similar in many ways to Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And I have to clarify, because Navasha and I are from East Cleveland, which is its own city. It has its own mayor, own police department.
It's not like east side of Cleveland. It's a different city.
It's connected. It's the first suburb of Cleveland, actually.
Uh-huh.
It was founded by Scottish immigrants, which you'll see some of the names and the, you know, the streets and stuff. And then it was founded as a village first in the late 1800s, and then as a city. And it was actually a community that had, in their decree, they included women's suffrage. I thought that was pretty interesting. And so eventually, and then Rockefeller had a whole lot of land on that in East Cleveland. That land was included, you know. So people and his employees built houses. So East Cleveland is known for its big houses. And so eventually in time, people migrated out to other suburbs and black people moved in. So in 1988 or 1984, it was a prominent black community. It was like 37,000 or so African-Americans living in East Cleveland. My family moved there in 1988. And I, you know, it was to me the most impressive part beyond the fact that everybody was black, even though I lived in another predominantly black community, was that the houses were so big. But it was because Rockefeller and his right. his employees built any house they wanted. That's how rich he was and so well off he was. And so it had its own ecosystem, its own vibe, but it's still connected to Cleveland. But it is specifically East Cleveland. Okay. Yeah, and it has its own school system, which is doing really well, actually. As well.
So, you know, people. Oh, you're going to say something phenomenal?
Yeah, but in terms of the commonalities, when I first. My sister relocated to Baltimore.
Your sister?
She attended, Goucher College. They come from a large family. And this is my baby sister, our baby sister, baby girl. And I used to come to visit her once a month to get out of Cleveland. I was working at the time at a before and after school program. And traveling is very important. So I'd always make time to travel. And the first time I arrived in Baltimore was actually during the 80s when I was in elementary school. There was a rites of passage conference here, and it was just a tremendous experience to see so many black folk, you know, concentrated in the city. And the energy, the vibrancy was something I never forgot. So there was also always a mystique about Baltimore. So I come back to Baltimore, visit my sister, and slowly fall in love with Baltimore. I discover that Baltimore is like Cleveland in terms of looking at post-industrialization, the resiliency of Baltimoreans. And then I reconnected with a wonderful woman by the name of Navasha.
Oh
and we fell in love in Baltimore. So there's even that much more of a mystique about.
Wait, you met Navasha here?
We reconnected here. We knew each other as children.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
We weren't like buddies at school or anything. I went to a different school. I went to a Cleveland public school, and he went to East Cleveland School. And so we didn't hang out in high school, but we were always involved in community work and in cultural work. But we weren't like necessarily buddies, though. But we know, our families know each other, though.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
But very common. Very common. And the commonalities are amazing, you know, between Baltimore and East Cleveland.
Because you always hear people say that. You know, people do this all the time, that folks in a certain city are more backward than people in another city. They don't stand up. They're not culturally or politically standing up to oppression that they and all this kind of stuff. But every time I hear you, not right as you're speaking, and I hear other people talk about their experiences in different cities, of course, there are nuances and cultural nuances and because of where you live and grow up and the geography and the place and that what it feels like. But it's not, I mean, it's not like night and day.
Right.
Not at all.
We're not talking about real serious differences, whether it's the police or the black community or whatever we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. It is a Republican state, though. That's the difference, I would say. Baltimore or Maryland, even though we have a Republican governor, which is a whole other conversation, a whole other show. But, you know, Baltimore is a little more liberal kind of town with a lot of foundations, a lot of universities. I think Cleveland, we have maybe two or three, maybe four universities. So it's not a lot of in-and-out energy as much as Baltimore. Like, there's a lot of fluctuation of energy and immigrants and people come into the city to bring vibrancy. The one thing my father always noticed is that in downtown Baltimore, there's a lot of black people down there, and Cleveland is not like that. When I get into the airport in Cleveland, it's all white people. Mm. I mean, it's almost like I'm back in the 60s or 70s. It's crazy. I'm always, and that's economic, as you know, and I'm always looking around like, this is crazy. So it does feel a little bit like that, but as far as the vibrancy and the brilliance of the people and the knowledge they have and how much they fought is the same. It's just spread out more because the land is so big, so it's like different communities spread out. But the people know each other, and they fight and they advocate and things like that. It's a different kind of battle because of the obvious racism. For instance, I remember when I was in college in the early 90s, the KKK had a rally downtown in Cleveland. I've never really heard of that happening here in Baltimore, not this part of Maryland. So just those kind of subtle racist things is what is the only difference I would say, because it's a Republican state. There's a mood, a different kind of racist old Alabama, Mississippi mood, not an East Coast progressive
mood. That's really interesting.
Mood. That's the only difference I would say.
Very front and center. Mm-hmm. Very front and center. Once again, to your point, Mark, you've had communities of resistance that have always existed. Here in Baltimore, in Cleveland. I remember being in college and a friend from Philadelphia who lived in North Philly. I spent a Thanksgiving holiday with him. That was an amazing experience as well. But in terms of just the similarities, the sites of resistance that exist that you don't often hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in terms of, you know, the climate, what we're dealing with in Baltimore and Cleveland, The resistance that exists and how individuals are expressing themselves individually and collectively is really amazing. We were able to take a group of Journey Project family organizers. We have the Journey Project here in Baltimore City. Once again, we secured funding to work with family organizers in Cherry Hill and Albemarle Square. And we were able to take these family organizers to East Cleveland, Ohio, to engage in conversations across state lines with other black families about tactics, about strategies that they're employing to combat, to confront issues related to police intimidation, police brutality. And it was a tremendous, tremendous experience for myself, for Navasha, but even more so for the families in East Cleveland and Baltimore to recognize the similarities and the importance of solidarity in this political moment.
That's fascinating. And I think that the also what you were saying about earlier about the lawsuits that are taking place in Cleveland, the payouts that Cleveland has done for
over
brutality.
Is that,
that's Baltimore.
Exactly. There you go.
I think that's everywhere.
I agree.
It's like reactionary versus proactive. It's like, oh, we'll wait till something happens and let's pay it off. It's just it's very disturbing. Very disturbing.
Well, conversation, you know, that we're hearing now here in Baltimore about tapping into the Rainy Day Fund to cover costs to rebuild the city as a result of the so-called riots. And I recall during the mid-2000s, you know, organizing with some of the fiercest organizers, you know, probably in the United States, I'll venture and say probably the world, who were involved in peer-to-peer actions. But in terms of those young people, making sure that there were funds available, really organizing to make sure that funds were available for jobs for youth, you know, during the summer months. I reflected on that, and I continue to reflect on that in terms of those youth challenging the political leadership at the time to tap into the Rainy Day Fund to provide monies for young people to have jobs. And now there's conversation about the city tapping into those rainy day funds today. And perhaps if they had invested properly, this wouldn't even be an issue. You know, young people are hungry.
Right.
You know, they know when they're being misled and they're looking for justice. And if adults aren't stepping up, they're going to seize the day in the moment. So here we are.
We are here. You know, I just think reflecting very quickly before we close is that and I was in Cuba, came back just last month, and one of the people I spoke to there was a professor and a writer who's he was Santeria, and he's white. He said to me that it was interesting. This fits in what you were saying about resistance. He said to me that Santeria is not a black religion. It's a religion based on African philosophy.
Yes.
And that it doesn't that people come in from every ethnic group are part of Santeria, and he said, but to be African means resistance.
That's right.
In this hemisphere, that's the way he was describing that sense. And when you were talking about that quote sticks in my head. I keep thinking about what he was saying that night, and that just fits into the reality of the situation here in America.
And, you know, there are a lot of conversations right now about how to provide funding for those in communities who need it the most. But the second part of that conversation is, you know, we hear that conjunction over and over again. But do they really have the capacity? You
right.
know? And so I think about Abu the Flute Maker. How dare you question the capacity of an Abu the Flute Maker? I think about Greta Carter, who has the Kevin L. Cooper Foundation, who has a Youth Day celebration every summer, and she raises her own money. How dare you question whether or not she has capacity? Grandma Edna, how dare you? So the capacity exists. Let's just switch the question or turn the question upside down. Do you, as a funder, as a foundation, have the capacity to recognize the strengths of these individuals who are going to do the work, whether or not, you know, they're supported for the sake of our children, for the sake of the future of Baltimore? So that resistance, boy, is very critical and present in Baltimore and in Cleveland and in East Cleveland.
And on that note, I think we'll wait for our next episode with Fanon Hill and Navasha Deya to bring them back here to have this conversation. Because we're having Cleveland, I really want them with us. They're both co-founders of Healing and Performing Arts co-founders of the Youth Resiliency Institute. Navasha is Director of Healing and Performing Arts, and Fanon Hill is Executive Director of the Youth Resiliency Institute. They do incredibly powerful work with rites of passage and more, and bring our two cities together.
That's right.
By exchanging, actually, and they bring this energy, this powerful cultural, political energy to all of us. So I want to thank you both for taking the time
to
come here.
Thank you for having
us. Appreciate you.
We're taking a brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll be hearing from Baltimore artists working to bridge the gap of disparities in Baltimore's art scene, which they call Art Apartheid. And on our way to break, we're hearing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes by Crosby, Stills, and Nash, released on this day in 1969. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.